Hello everyone, this is Bill Von Nahar with another edition of Moments in History. Today we're get some stories out of the American History Magazine, October 2019. There's different sections in this magazine. One is called SCOTUS 101, which has to do with the Supreme Court. It's written by Daniel Moskowitz, and it's entitled Schooled in Speech. Schooled in Speech, the core constitutional provisions constraining action that impinges upon individual rights inhibit not only the federal government, but also every state and its subordinate governments, such as counties, cities, sanitation districts, and school districts. Historically, the Supreme Court has hesitated to apply those limits to public education. In a 1940 decision, Justice Felix Frankfurter explained that a more energetic application of the Bill of Rights to schools would amount to no less than the pronouncement of pedagogical and psychological dogma in a field where courts possess no marked or certainly no controlling competence. It took the Vietnam War and three gutsy adolescents to persuade justices that the free speech guarantees apply in classrooms also. In March 1965, the first massed American combat troops landed in Vietnam. That July, President Lyndon Johnson said he would send another 50,000 men there and begin drafting 35,000 young men a month. In November, the war's first large-scale battle claimed almost 300 American lives. Opposition at home billowed. On November 20th, 8,000 protested in Oakland. The following Saturday, 20,000 protesters marched against the war in Washington, D.C. Polls showed about a third of Americans opposed military involvement in Vietnam. In Des Moines, Iowa, Mary Beth Tinker, age 13, her brother John, age 15, and Christopher Eckhart, 15 years old, were part of a small group of students who agreed with the protesters. These young Iowans decided that a show of opposition, they would support New York Democratic Senator Robert Kennedy's call for a Christmas truce. The teenagers planned to make their point by fasting on December 16, 1965, and by wearing black armbands throughout the holidays. Administrators of local schools, learning of the imminent protest, hastily forbade students to wear armbands, with violators subject to suspension. On the chosen day, John, Chris, and four friends wore armbands bearing the peace symbol to Theodore Roosevelt High. Mary Beth wore one to Warren Harding Junior High. When they refused requests to remove their armbands, all seven were sent home. The Tinkers' younger siblings wore armbands to their grade school without consequence. The Tinker and Eckerd families, who were active in pacifist causes, did not accept the suspensions quietly. On behalf of their children, the father sought a federal court order barring schools from disciplining students from exercising their constitutional right to express a view on a vital political issue. The U.S. District Court threw out the suit, saying school authorities had the power to squelch gestures that they thought would stir disturbances. The families appealed that ruling to the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in St. Louis. Hearing the case, the three-judge panel took the unusual step of punting the matter to the entire court. The full eight-judge body split 4-4, which allowed the decision dismissing the case to stand. By the time Tinker v. Des Moines reached the next forum, the U.S. Supreme Court, it was 1968. The war was tearing at the nation. Reluctant to wade into the controversy, the justice nonetheless feared that refusing the case would encourage lower courts to use it as a precedent to approve school bans on peaceful protests against the war. As early as 1931, the High Court had decreed the constitutional protection extended to expressive speech, statements by symbol rather than in words. In oral argument, the students' lawyers argued that what was at stake was the First Amendment guarantee of freedom of speech. The school district insisted that it not only could act to maintain order and discipline, but had an absolute duty to do so. When the justices met in private session after oral argument, two things instantly became clear. First, all agreed that to maintain an orderly environment conducive to learning, school authorities needed leeway. The schools are in great trouble, Justice Hugo Black ranted. Children need discipline. The country is going to ruin because of it. He and Justice John Harlan II wanted to uphold the school board's ban on armbands. But the other seven justices sided with the students. Hesitant to involve the courts and school administrations remained. The trick was to find a way to void the ban without cramping administrators' capacity to run schools. Justice Abe Fortas declared his readiness to rule that the students could not be disciplined for protesting, but added that the school authorities can and must control the schools. On the day Tinker was argued at the Supreme Court, the court unanimously overturned an Arkansas ban on teaching evolution. Fortas had written that school free speech opinion, so Justice Earl Warren assigned him the Tinker option. To write it, Fortas had to find a balance between free speech rights and the need for discipline in schools. In his opinion for the seven-justice majority, Fortas resoundingly rejected the notion that public school students did not enjoy constitutional protections. First Amendment rights, applied in light of the special characteristics of the school environment, are available to teachers and students, he wrote. It can hardly be argued that either the students or teachers shed their constitutional right of freedom of speech or expression at the schoolhouse gate. Maintaining that right might spawn disagreements and disturbances, but our Constitution says we must take that risk, and our history said that it is this sort of hazardous freedom, this kind of openness, that is the basis of our national strength and of the independence and vigor of Americans, he said. On the other hand, Fortas continued, the court has repeatedly emphasized the need for affirming the comprehensive authority of the states and of school officials, consistent with fundamental constitutional safeguards to prescribe and control conduct in the schools. Des Moines school officials feared that the wearing of armbands would trigger arguments and disruptions. Tinker provided advocates of staunch school discipline with a formula for constitutionally exercising their authority. School systems may bar a speech given reasonable evidence that such speech would materially and substantially interfere with good scholastic order. Des Moines had no such proof, but in the decades since that standard has seen wide use to justify prohibiting school demonstrations. Despite giving school administrators a rationale for limiting expressions of controversial views, Tinker represented a momentous innovation in the recognition of students' constitutional rights, University of Chicago law professor Justine Driver wrote recently. For the first time, the Supreme Court recognized the students retain the essential power to communicate their ideas to one another. Such communication is not extraneous to the educational process, but instead forms an integral part of that process, and public schools have an acute responsibility to tolerate dissident speech. Judges have invoked Tinker in hundreds of cases upholding students' rights to demonstrate, publish controversial articles in student publications, wear hair longer than authorities think seemly, and yes, in a 2008 case in Arkansas, protest a school uniform policy by wearing black armbands. In 2013, after a career as a pediatric nurse, Mary Beth Tinker retired. Each year, she tours American high schools, telling her story and encouraging student political activism. That's the end of the article written by Daniel Moskowitz, Schooled in Speech. Within this same magazine, American History, October 2019, we have another article that is entitled American Schemers. American Schemers is written by Peter Carlson. Mr. Carlson writes Facts of Lear, L-E-E-R, Facts of Lear. He begins, America has spawned hordes of skillful scammers, but only a prescient few have concocted a scheme so brilliant that it became a work of art. Howard W. Kroger Babb is among those precious few. If there was an American Schemers Hall of Fame, Kroger Babb would be in that pantheon. I'm just a country boy with a shoe shine, he liked to say, as any other country hustler cozying up to a mark would say. Actually, Babb was a country boy with a genius for salesmanship, showmanship, and an unrelenting self-promotion. He was more accurate when he billed himself as America's fearless young showman. Born in 1906 in Lee's Creek, Ohio, Babb in his youth worked at a Kroger grocery, hence the nickname. He grew up to be a sports writer and a newspaper ad salesman. In his 20s, he got a job promoting the Ohio-based Kirkery's Warner's cinema chain. He made his bones as a flack with an outrageous stunt, burying a man alive for 6 days in front of a theater in Wilmington, Ohio. The poor fellow Babb billed him as Digger O'Dell, got air and food through a shaft positioned so that the customers could gawk down at him before buying tickets. In 1939, Babb traveled nationwide peddling Dust to Dust, a low-budget melodrama about a naive high school girl who gets pregnant. The cheesy plot, enlivened by footage of an actual birth and a B-roll from a U.S. Army training film about venereal disease, featuring hideously infected genitalia. Dust to Dust was awful, but quite popular, which inspired Babb to create the masterpiece of sex and hype that made him rich, Mom and Dad. This dumb high school girl, very beautiful, wanted to know more about her body, about sex, Babb said in 1977, summarizing Mom and Dad for a Washington Post reporter. But every time she asked her mother a question, the mother said, "Tut, tut, you're too young to know." So she went to a party, danced with a good-looking stranger, and she got pregnant, Babb said. Babb stole that plot from Dust to Dust and hired Mildred Horn, his mistress, and later his second wife, to write the script. In 1944, Babb contracted with B movie director William Bodine to shoot the movie. Nicknamed One Shot because he seldom did a second take, Bodine filmed Mom and Dad in 6 days. Total cost $62,000. Not only did Babb swipe the plot of Dust to Dust, he also stole its gimmick, incorporating the same delivery room and horror show VD footage into Mom and Dad. What the master added, his special sauce, was the Babb ballyhoo treatment, rooted in the notion that nothing sells like controversy. His company, Hygienic Productions, sanctimoniously touted Mom and Dad as a high-minded educational experience. Mom and Dad is not just a show, Babb would tell anybody who'd listen. It is a lighthouse in the darkness of human ignorance. It peels aside the veils of sexual superstition and suppression surrounding nature's most glorious and incredible act. It is the most vital presentation of the vast American public has ever been privileged to attend. Who could resist, especially when ads screamed, "Once in a lifetime comes a presentation that truly pulls no punches. Now you can see the motion picture that dares discuss and explain sex as never before been seen or heard." And there were a lot of those ads. A week before Mom and Dad was to play a local Bijou, Advance Man plastered the area with posters. They also bought space in local newspapers for ads that frequently inspired ministers to denounce the movie as smut. If clerics ignored the bait, Babb mailed pseudonymous letters to the editor decrying Mom and Dad. Babb delivered more than a movie. The Mom and Dad Roadshow included one Elliot Forbes, billed as a sex expert and lecturing on the secrets of sensible sex. Two women in nurses' uniforms stood by to treat audience members who might faint from shock. In a genius stroke of hullabaloo, Babb insisted theater operators segregate screenings by sex. He'd schedule shows for women at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m., pumping up excitement for the men-only event at 9 p.m. Halfway through the movie, after protagonist Joan weeps to learn that handsome pilot who pregnated her had died in a plane crash, Mom and Dad stopped. The house lights came up for an intermission, during which Forbes inveighed on behalf of sex ed while the nurses hawked a facts-only life book written by Mildred Horn. The film resumed with the live birth and the VD footage, which actually did cause some viewers to faint. In Minneapolis, Babs bragged, "We had them lying there by the dozens on marble benches in the lobbies, like slabs in a morgue." The movie closed with a sequence featuring Babb himself. If you agree that these pictures have been bold and shocking enough, then you've learned a very worthwhile lesson from them, he declaimed. "I wish you'd shown the management your appreciation at this time by your applause." And audiences applauded. Local censors banned Mom and Dad countless times, but Babb and his lawyer, Henry Fox, fought back. "Oh my God, you don't have any idea of the vigor with which opponents pursued this film," Fox later recalled. "They swore they'd died before they'd showed a thing." But Babb and Fox generally won their court fights, arguing that Mom and Dad was educational, a lighthouse in the darkness, and a valuable tool in the fight against teen pregnancy and social diseases. Through the 40s and 50s, a dozen or more Mom and Dad roadshows circulated simultaneously, each with its own fake Elliot Forbes and fake nurses. An all-black outfit featured Olympic hero Jesse Owens delivering the Forbes falderal. Between 1944 and 1977, Mom and Dad grossed between $40 million and $100 million, not counting receipts for those Facts of Life books. Babb had other hits. He bought Kamajora, a documentary featuring naked Africans that he flacked with the line, "They wear nothing but the wind." He imported Summer with Monica, a 1953 film by an obscure Swede named Ingmar Bergman that he retitled Monica, the Story of a Bad Girl. But it was Mom and Dad that made Babb a legend of hype. Retired comfortably in Palm Springs, California in 1977, 3 years before his death, the wizard of sexploitation grumbled that movies had become too smutty. "The pictures got just so bad, so filthy," Babb told an interview. "I just don't have any taste for them anymore." That ends the article by Peter Carlson, and it was called Facts of Lear. Facts of Lear. Finally, in this same magazine, American History, October 2019, is an interview. This is written by Richard Ernsberger. Richard Ernsberger, Echoes of Empire. There's a Daniel Imwar, associate professor of history at Northwestern University, and is the author of How to Hide an Empire, A History of the Greater United States. This article is written in an interview format with a question and an answer. Question. They're interviewing Daniel Imwar. "You assert the United States has a long, unacknowledged history of empire." Answer. "Often, when we speak about American empire, we talk about imperialism, from Manifest Destiny to military interventions in the Middle East. When I say the history of the United States is one of empire, I'm referring not to imperialism, but to territory, not to the character of the country, but to its shape. Ever since gaining independence from Britain, the United States has contained not only states, but territories. These aren't small. By 1940, one person in eight living in the United States resided in the territories, and the country contained more colonial subjects than African Americans or immigrants. Yet the territories, particularly those overseas, haven't always been easy for historians studying the United States to see." Question. What accounts for this lack of awareness? Answer. I grew up on the American mainland, and at no point in my education do I remember ever seeing a map of the United States that had Puerto Rico on it, though Puerto Rico has been part of the United States for 120 years. The same is true of the census, whose statistical calculations, how long people live, how many people live in cities, and so forth, largely have included only the mainland and the states, not overseas territories. The larger issue is surely this. There has to be a long-standing, radically informed sense on the mainland that certain parts of the United States count, while other parts don't, that certain parts of the country are truly America, where others are merely possessions. Question. Seventh graders at Western Michigan training schools caught on to this in 1941. Answer. After Pearl Harbor, President Franklin Roosevelt enjoined Americans to follow the war on maps. Seventh grade girls in Kalamazoo tried that, using a Rand McNally war atlas. The atlas listed Hawaii as a foreign country, along with Puerto Rico and Alaska. Wondering how an attack on foreign Hawaii could have led the United States into war, the students asked Rand McNally what kept Hawaii from being part of America. The publisher replied that because Hawaii is foreign to our continental shores, it couldn't be shown as part of the United States. This small example shows the persistence of the assumption that some parts of the United States are really part of the country, while others aren't. Question. How did the United States justify annexing the Philippines after the Spanish-American War? Answer. President William McKinley said the United States had an obligation to civilize the Filipinos. More broadly, the Philippines' annexation was part of a forthright turn by America's leadership away from what had been the prevailing pattern among imperial nations of settler colonization toward the ruling of large, distant populations. We don't normally think of the United States as a colonial power in that sense, but by the 1920s, the country had the world's fifth largest empire by population, some 19 million colonial subjects. Question. Many white Americans in the lower 48 weren't keen to acquire Alaska, Hawaii, and other territories known to non-whites. Answer. Racism comes in flavors. There's the racism that proposes that whites rule non-whites. Another kind insists that white people have little to do with non-whites as possible. In the United States in the 19th century, you can see these variations fighting with each other. Much resistance to colonial empire comes not from sympathy with the colonized, but from the desire to preserve the whiteness of the United States. Question. After 1945, America did something very unusual. Answer. The historical pattern had been, when you get more power, you get more territory. At the end of World War II, the United States ruled a larger population in colonies and occupied territories than on the mainland. But instead of going on an imperial spree, the country sought to distance itself from the colonial model by ending its occupations, letting go of its largest colony, the Philippines, and making states of Hawaii and Alaska. Instead of becoming a world-girding colonial power, the United States became what I call a pontilistic empire. The United States continues to hold colonies, millions live in them today, but its main interest seems to be in small enclaves, such as hundreds of foreign military bases that dot the globe. Question. How did science influence America's shift to decolonization? Answer. Historically, great powers have sought large colonies for access to strategic resources. In the industrial world, that meant rubber, palm oil, tin, and the like. But now colonization is not the only way to get those resources. You can get them through chemistry. In the 1940s, to a remarkable extent, the United States developed substitutes for key raw materials. When Japan cut off America's supply of natural rubber, American scientists learned to synthesize rubber from petroleum, substitute nylon for hemp and silk, and swap chloroquine for quinine. After the war, able to substitute technology for territory, the United States didn't need large colonies as much anymore. question. Describe America's attitude towards its overseas charges. In 1913, Woodrow Wilson described these territories as outside the charmed circle of our national life. People in the territories couldn't vote for president. They have no meaningful representation in Congress. The Constitution doesn't apply to them. Exclusion from all three branches of government has had serious consequences. In wartime, territories have tended to be sacrifice zones. In my book, I tell how World War II, the Philippines became a bloodlands. In peacetime, doctors, lawyers, and other experts have been drawn to the territories as laboratories where ideas can be tested with relatively little oversight. Question, America's empire endures. How? Response, that empire endures in American Samoa, Guam, the Northern Marianas, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands, and their 3 to 4 million inhabitants, and in foreign military bases. A recent count put them at 800 military bases. The consequences of empire are palpable. In the 1940s, Rand McNally doubted whether Hawaii was truly American. More recently, Barack Obama, whose father was from Kenya and who was born and raised in Hawaii and elsewhere in the Pacific, was the target of rumors about whether he was an American. If you look at the origins of birtherism, Donald Trump's entry ticket into presidential politics, it's clear that it was triggered by Obama's Pacific birth and upbringing, not just his being black. And that's the end of the interview that is presented by Richard Ernsberger, Echoes of Empire. And that also was in the American History Magazine, October 2019. And I think that brings us to the end of our session today. We appreciate you listening, and anytime you have any suggestions or ideas, give us a call and let us know. Otherwise, until next time, this is Bill Von Haar with Moments in History. Thank you for listening.